Perfect. Okay.
Okay.
Well, as the topic of tonight's talk is how your teen's brain can focus on flourishing, or rather not, anxiety. So it's a bit of a mouthful. Some of you might have been at the one we did previously before lockdown. So you can even imagine what that looked like. It's on the website. It's all about how to help our teens to deal with disappointment. So I tried to steer well away from that. And what I would like to focus on in today's building leadership session is on the whole topic of really the biology of your teen's brain, because I think that can explain a lot. So I won't really be dipping too much into other things. I will obviously be referring to resilience, which obviously is the other side of anxiety. But as resilience is the virtue for next term, you'll get more than enough on resilience then. So to start really, just to mention, I will put up on the website a couple of resources that I've used. I've dipped into Dr. Kevin Majors. Some of you may be familiar with him. He is a psychologist in Harvard, and he actually came to speak to parents in Rosemont a number of years back. And he's a very interesting podcast, and he also has a lot of resources on his own website. So I'll be sharing those with you. So the first thing I suppose to start with is the science of your teen's brain. As those of you who this is your line of work, you may know that the teenage brain has long been neglected in the field of neuroscience, neuropsychology. And the main focus has tended to be on early childhood and also on the elderly, I suppose, dealing with things of dementia and all sorts of challenges at the other end of the life cycle. So most people actually thought until not so long ago that the teenage brain was really rather similar to the adult brain. It was just a couple of miles behind. I'm happy to say that that's not correct, and I hope that's comforting for you, because there are many differences in the teenage brain, many opportunities, challenges along the way, which I'm sure you're familiar with in your daily life, but it's just helpful to know that it's not obviously at the same development as the adult brain. It's a time of unique vulnerabilities, as we know very well and we talked about before. It's also a time to harness exceptional strengths. And it's important to remember what capacities also in that regard, in terms of vulnerabilities, what capacities are not happening in your daughter's brain during her teenage years. There's a breathtaking range of capacities, but there are also more challenges in many ways because of the challenges they're living, which is social media, internet, and things that we touched on briefly in the last building leadership session. So I suppose the problem is for us sometimes is the fact that they look physically more like adults than maybe their younger siblings. They look a little bit more like yourself or himself. And so we tend to treat them more like adults. You know, the typical refrain you might have heard from your own parents, would you act like you look, or whatever. But it's also good to remind them that they're growing into young adults. And to treat them, you know, that respect for their opinion, that respect for their effort, wanting to hear their voice, all of that, because that does help them to step into a new space. But I suppose the biology of the brain, essentially, well, the teen's brain, as you know, it's going through a massive growth spurt, okay? By the time they're six, now this might sound, their brains have already about 90 to 95% of the adult size, but there's a huge amount of remodeling needing to be done. And that's done largely during the teenage years. And it happens really, and it continues right up to the mid-20s. So some brain changes will happen at different stages in your teens, you know, and you'll notice that it varies hugely depending on your teen. And obviously with boys, it's also very different. You know, boys can be maybe a year and a half behind the girls sometimes in their linguistic, their processing, all sorts of things. It's no reflection on the boys at all. It's just the way the brain is developing. So I'm going to ask Maria to share my one and only slide this evening, because it might be helpful, because we're just going to look actually at the brain for a brief moment. Because the teenage brain is a paradox. It has an overabundance of gray matter. So if you look at the gray matter really is the area really you might, well, I'll explain it a little bit. It's basically the neurons which form the basic building blocks of the brain. So it's an overabundance of that. The main change that happens in your teen's brain is any unused connection in the gray matter which is used, and that's the thinking and the processing part of their brain, that's pruned away. So, so you'll often hear it, you know, use it or lose it idea. Okay, and so then the other part of the brain, unfortunately in this particular image you don't see grey and white because I want to show something else with this slide, but mainly you'll know from looking yourselves probably at your own biology book in school what the grey matter looks like. And then of course you have an undersupply of what we call the white matter. And the white matter is literally like the connective wiring in the brain that helps information to flow from one part of the brain to the other. And the brain becomes more efficient based on, I suppose, you might say, how the wiring works and also how the grey matter is used. And it's the use it or lose it principle, which I've talked about many times before. So the red part there, the prefrontal cortex, if you might think of the wiring of the brain that's taking place during adolescence, it starts from the back of the brain and works its way to the front. So the red part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is the last part of the house, if you might say, of the brain that actually gets wired. And that's very interesting because the prefrontal cortex is the decision-making part of the brain and it's responsible for your teen's ability to plan, to think, and to reflect on the consequences of their actions, to solve problems, to control impulses. Okay? And that continues to be wired up right onto their mid-20s. Now that explains a lot, because if the prefrontal cortex, is still developing, they're often relying on the part of the brain, which is the blue part, which is the amygdala. And they'll often rely on that to make decisions and solve problems more than adults do. And the amygdala, as you'll see from the slide, is more associated with the emotions. Okay, so that's everything to do with fear, with joy, with impulses, with instinctive behavior, with aggression more in boys, and all of that. So you've probably noticed that sometimes your teen's thinking and behavior seems quite mature on one level, you know, and maybe they can have very good conversations about politics and all of that, but other times they seem to behave or think completely illogically, impulsively, or emotionally. And that really is because of the back-to-front development of the brain. And that's their brains are still under construction. You could say they're 80% of the way towards maturing, but there's a 20% gap in the wiring. And that's why there's mood swings, there's irritability, there's impulsiveness, there's explosiveness, there's inability to focus, to follow through. And that's why they're very tempted by all kinds of risky behavior. And they're a bit like a new Ferrari, you know? They haven't been road tested yet. They're all revved up, but they're not sure. No, they're not really sure where to go yet. Okay. So I suppose that's the first thing really to say there. The emotions really is the second part of this. So that's really the biology of the brain. And the second part of this really is the emotions, and you can unshare that, Maria, for a moment if you like. The emotions, as we know, during teenage years, they tend to rule their lives. Now obviously it depends, you can't say anything with absolute, you know, I can't be so pejorative about this because obviously every teen is quite different, but you probably will notice that emotions are stronger during their teenage years. And it can be, you know, I suppose they can't really smooth the process. They can't really connect the frontal cortex with the amygdala, basically is what's happening. That sort of wiring hasn't happened. And that's where we step in really as caring adults, to try to help them, you know, to filter, to try to help them to regulate their emotions. We need to be a bit of a mirror for them, mirroring things backwards and forwards. And that can be harder or less hard depending on the teen we're talking about, because, you know, teens find it hard to articulate how they're feeling because their emotions are so strong sometimes. Or they can start articulating really, really well and it can sound like a soap opera. You know, you think you can listen, you go, God, where did you get that from? And it sounds, you know, quite scary sometimes. And again, I suppose, they can also be surprised themselves about emotional they can get with things. But emotions really for us are like the red flag. They tell us that something's up. And they tell us that whether it's the fear, whether it's the anger, whether it's the upset, whether it's the laughter, whether it's the quiet, depending on the teen, it's the whole range. You know, the introvert, the extrovert, whatever. The truth is a world without emotion is difficult to imagine. But it can be it can be difficult for us sometimes to distinguish between what we would perceive as normal, teenage sort of outbursts, and something that could be a little bit more challenging or more something we might need to give more support to. What makes a teen's response more difficult, as I said, is that their world is driven by emotion and not by reason. And they can often describe their lives as a drama, awful, or as amazing. And it can go from literally from awe-inspiring to tears within a very short period of time. And it's harder for them to manage them, as I said, because the frontal cortex is not fully developed. The third aspect, I suppose, of a teenager's, you might say, brain is hormones. Now, it's not that teenagers have more hormones than young adults. I mean, young adults in their early 20s. But they react differently because it's the first time they're seeing these hormones. Okay, so they're not sure how to deal with them. Okay, so that's really the essence of it. There is also a hormone, which is, I won't even try to pronounce it, it's something like tetrahydroprenoline, and it's TPH, and it's released in adults and in teenagers when we experience stress. And in adults, it's a calming influence. In teenagers, it tends to heighten the stress levels. And so that can lead, that's a hormone that can heighten things for them. And because of that, they can be a little less protected sometimes to, the emotion of fear and anxiety. But I have to say, while hormones explain a certain amount of what's happening in the teenage brain, there's an awful lot more going on. So I think we do them a disservice by justifying them. Oh, there's loads of hormones going on. Hopefully that'll sort itself out. It'll find its own balance and we can talk rationally in a year or two. There's an awful lot more going on in the teenage brain. And as I've said so many times before, if we step away from that, the danger is the use it or lose it paradigm means that they will lose the possibilities for some connections, which come a lot easier when you're a teenager, because there's a greater plasticity of the brain when you're a teen. So if you've ever looked at an older person trying to learn a musical instrument, it's a very different thing watching an older person as watching a younger person. And because there's greater plasticity, there's greater ability there to connect, because their brain is, it's like rewiring a new house for the first time. And it's new rewiring, or, as opposed to old wiring. And it's just easier. So I suppose the point is that hormones can't explain everything. They can explain some of what our teenagers are experiencing, but there's a lot more going on. There's a lot of new connections happening. There's a lot of new chemicals, neurotransmitters, et cetera, et cetera, going on. So it's a true wonder. It's a tremendous window of opportunity for remarkable accomplishments, but also there is elements of risk-taking there that can be more challenging. I suppose the other thing just to mention about plasticity, and I would just relate this to the topic again in terms of flourishing or in terms of anxiety. Because of the plasticity, their experiences, certain negative experiences, are not as permanent as they might be in an adult. And there was research done in the Yale University on that back in 2011, and there's a lot of research continually being done at that all the time. But there is obviously the vulnerability there. Flip side to that is the resilience. And I'll just mention for a moment is that the lovely thing about resilience is that you're not born with it. So if you have a teen, you feel, good, there's not much resilience going on here. Well, it's something that can be learned. And that's what you're trying to hardwire when your teen is making the connection between the frontal cortex and the amygdala and the other parts of their brain, you're trying to wire in that resilience. So it's a great opportunity for resilience in a teenager. And I just want to quote from Frances Jensen, who's written that famous book, The Teenage Brain. She says, while teens may be more vulnerable to negative effects of stress, they are also better equipped than most adults to learn how to positively respond to stress. I think that's important, because as caring adults, and I'd say for yourselves as parents, you naturally step into the space of protection, And obviously, a lot of challenges that are out there now for our teens were not there when you and I were teenagers. We didn't have social media. We didn't have internet in the same ways they have. We didn't have all of these things, So there are a lot more challenges, drugs, all of these negative risk-taking experiences are much more accessible. And I suppose because of that, we can tend to be much more fearful for them. And that's why it's important. We will be having a building leadership talk on the whole area of social media and the latest apps and all of that. And that's why it's important that we're aware and we're very connected with that. But at the same time, if we bring that, the protective nurture element of a parent too much into the fore in this, the danger is our teens don't step into the space of overcoming their fears, step into the space of vulnerability, which is where growth takes place, and step into the space of understanding their emotions. Emotions are not a negative thing. They're just red flagging, look, you're not comfortable with something. And anxiety comes from fear. And fear is an emotion. It's a feeling. It's a response. And Dr. Kevin Majors has a very interesting thing to say about that. He says, anxiety is a negative response to the hormone adrenaline. And he says, what you see in elite athletes, or what you see in high performers, is when they experience that sense of that adrenaline rush, they don't shut it down as negative. They think, bring it on. And I think that's something very interesting for us to consider. You know, are we encouraging, I mean by this healthy risk, are we saying to our teens, bring it on? You know, and not shutting down anxiety. You can't say, thou shalt not be anxious, because that's like shutting down an emotion. Fear is a natural, you know, survival instinct that we have. And if we didn't have it, it would be more dangerous. So it's natural that our teens are fearful. They're more fearful than adults because they're stepping out into a world that's new. They haven't had the experiences, the life experiences we've had. But it is very interesting to consider it. Are we encouraging our teens to reflect on the positive side, on the opportunities that are there? Or are we framing it in a negative way, which makes it more difficult each time than to step into the space of fear? So I suppose it's giving them the opportunity to take control, to take care of it, obviously, because if we flip over to anxiety for a moment, you know, we need to help our teens look after sleep, look after their screen time, look after their nutrition, look after their socializing, their family life, you know, keep on top of their academics, all of these things which they find challenging. That's taking care. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, he was actually just yesterday, and I was telling her that I said, I'm giving a talk to some of our parents on this topic. And she said, well, she's a GP. And she said, that's really interesting, she said, because I have a number of teenagers coming to me in the practice, and they've been misdiagnosed as having ADHD, but what they actually have is anxiety. And she said, I'm realizing, and we had a chat about screen time, we had a chat about just basic self-care in teenagers. And she was saying, that's very interesting, because that's what I'm finding, is that teenagers sometimes come across so confident that we think, well, and they're so, it seems to be always telling us as adults, well, no, I wouldn't be doing this, and hygiene is about this, and self-care means this, and did you know you need to, you know, there's vitamin D and this green, and this is a super vegetable. And we think, well, they've it all sussed, whereas of course they don't. So her point really was self-care can be a challenge for teens, and we need to help them to do more of it. But anyway, I suppose it's helping them to take control of their lives in a very healthy way, to set goals, even small goals, working towards them one step at a time. That's all ownership for learning we're trying in school all the time. And that they would take time out from social media and things like that, which is really, really important. And then obviously that us as caring adults would be in that space regularly as caring and listening adults, because that's what's hugely important. As you know, that parents... Recent studies shown in Australia that parents are still three times more important than peers to your teen. Okay, and I think that's a very, very helpful statistic to remind yourself of. When she won't even look at you in the eye, when she's, almost taken a vow of silence, when there's such maybe, you know, emotions being pent up, you're still three times more important than her best in school. Okay, and it's important to keep telling ourselves that. Often when we experience, I suppose, outbursts of anger or upset and things like that, we sometimes, as I said, don't know how to distinguish sometimes whether that's the natural experience or is that something more we need to be concerned about. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I suppose what we're ultimately trying hard to help our teens to do, I don't know if you remember the expression, a relation of mine who my aunt used to always say to us when she'd visit, oh, that child, she's still hiding behind the apron, she's still holding on to those apron strings. And I always remember asking, my dad, what does that mean? And it was the whole idea that, you know, and she was a toddler at the time, so it was quite harsh, really. But I suppose it was the whole idea that the natural, you're trying to help your children to step more into the space of, step away a little more from dependence to the space of independence, and then to the space of interdependence. And that is painful. So, and I think that's important to talk about that, you know, with your other half there, or another relative or a good friend. What's that trajectory like in our teen's life? How are we helping her to take more ownership for her life? You know, because it's not easy. And it does mean we get to see suffering. And how do we feel about that? You know, we talked last time about friendships, potentially challenging friendships our teens might have. But it's important that we only step into those friendships when it's necessary. But we're all the time supporting, mentoring, scaffolding our teens into facing the spaces they need to face, because that's helping them grow, and that's helping the prefrontal cortex. They're processing, they're thinking, they're working it out, and there's less impulse. The danger is otherwise that their growth is held back. You know, their emotional growth is held back, and they won't. And we know ourselves from being teenagers too. You know that if effort's involved, we should step away. And there's a big effort involved in emotional growth. And that's where we need to help our teens to make the effort. You know, you can do this. Why are you afraid of the other? Why would that be so bad? Well, what are the consequences? What's the worst thing that could happen here if that test went wrong? You know, I heard a recent one today, and I hear it a lot. You know, teens would say, "Miss, I haven't studied for that test. I'm going to, you know," or they might tell you, "Look, I didn't show up last week, and it's really why." And say, "Well, I was sick." And they go, "Really?" And then some of them were terribly honest and say, "Not really, Miss. I have three tests and I haven't studied for them." And I think that's, you know, it's great that they can admit that. But I suppose what we're trying to help them to do is, well, feel the fear and do it anyway. It's not the end of the world. You have to face the consequences maybe of not having studied enough or not having whatever. So we don't want to arrest the growth and the maturing and the development. What we're trying to help them to do is, and that's why we don't awfulize things. I'm not sure if that's quite a word, but we don't over-dramatize things either. You know, if there's a bad test result, but there's an awful lot of learning there, you know, she knows now she can't leave her learning to the last minute. Well, that's what's more important. And that she stepped into that space of fear and overcome the butterflies in her stomach and gone to school or faced the teacher and said, "Listen, I didn't do this," or whatever it is. Well, that's more positive than a test result in certain cases. And that's, you know, as parents, it's your call there, you know. So I suppose we've had to help them. But as I said, we can inadvertently turn our teens into victims, you know, taking away that possibility of maturing. So I suppose in all of this, flourishing is really a lot to do trying to encourage positive teen behavior, but they would understand what's happening. We're not just looking for good behavior reports. We want them to understand why and support why it is good to be resilient, why it is good to be courageous, why it is good to persevere at things, why it's good to be patient and thoughtful, and to be emotionally mature and robust, you know, and what that looks like. And that's what this is about, you know, is helping them with that. The negative teen behaviors or responses we're trying to, I suppose, help them to face down really are, you know, impatience, impulsiveness, instability in a way, you know, we're trying to help them grow all the time. And then emotional hijacking, you know, that if they don't face a fear, something simple as, you know, I just don't want to go into that test, or I don't want to go into that exam, that MUSEI exam, and they get used to not doing it. Well, in their brain, what actually happens is, it's like they've created a pigeonhole. You know, it's like all these cubby holes in their brain. And in that those cubby holes, is a pigeonhole that says maths test. And every time maths test comes up, their emotional response to that gets stronger and stronger and stronger until they can't go there. And it becomes more problematic. Whereas the more we help them to step into the natural fears of, do you know what? You know, you do need to do this. And you will. And what's the worst thing that can happen? And what else, the conversation about, look, how are we going to sit down and study? And structure isn't something that comes easy to teens, as we know. So we need to help them with that. But I suppose it's just that point of helping them not to be hijacked by their emotions. But it's important that they acknowledge their emotions, that they go, what's happening here? You know, why am I, you know, why do I have sweaty palms? Why am I shallow breathing, et cetera, et cetera. But what's that pointing to? You know, and the two big things for girls are always academics and friendships. All the studies show those are two things that teenage girls tend to get more fearful about than anything. So what can we do as caring adults? Well, how they spend their time is crucial, because what we're trying to do is get the wiring right between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. Okay, so what you're trying to do is build good habits and also help them use their time well. Okay, so for example, things like, so what's becoming hardwired? What are their preferred activities and skills? And this is all about creating flourishing, you know, because I do notice oftentimes, you know, some of the girls will say to you in leaving cert, miss, I have my music and I have my GAA and I have my netball and stuff and I'm in my leaving cert. But they'll say, miss, I'm keeping that up, you know. Now, it's every teen's decision with their parents or whatever. But it's so helpful when they can manage those activities along, because it gives them that holistic approach to life. They bring that into their adult life. But it also hardwiring their brain all the time. And they're getting the, you might say, the stress dump physically through those activities. And as we know, that's what sport does. It's like a stress dump. They dump their stresses in it. So it's a good thing to have in the back of our mind always, with their activities and skills, is there a sport there? Whatever that sport is, it doesn't matter. Is there some sort of sport going on? Music, you know, music is all about, you know, delayed gratification, as we know, because you have to build up the skill all of the time, but it's beauty. It gives rest, it gives free fall, it helps them just to be calm. And it's also beauty, so it's inspiration. Study. And the academics, because what's happening is, as we know, is that what teenagers think that, you know, the typical line is, yeah, I know, I'll just cram that, you know, and they're always so envious of the one in the class who seems to just, oh, sure, she's got a photographic brain, miss, you know, yeah, this all the time, you know, I'd love that, you know. And you realise, well, of course, some students do have, you know, a great ability to remember facts, or, you know, the scientific side of the brain is better, or the artistic side, whatever it is. But the truth of the matter is, it's all about connections, connections, connections. So if they're studying, you know, doing their homework every night, and they're doing a bit of study at the weekend, if they're in, you know, obviously in their exam years, they're building the connections all the time. And that's an activity that becomes a pleasure for them, because they realise they start to begin to enjoy it. Whereas the cramming never really works. It doesn't help build up that sense of enjoyment of their academics and take the stress out of it. And that's why we need to focus so much on just the everyday humdrum sort of organising of the study, the getting through it, etc. So what we're doing there is we're helping them shape their brain. And that they bring that into adulthood. And just to mention, as I said, structure is a challenge, as I've said. And we need to stay in their face a little bit with that. Okay, so how many teens might say to you things small, you know, yeah, miss, I studied, yeah, no, I just can't study, you know, so I need to listen to music. Now, obviously, they can listen to music if it's artistic, you know, if it's classical music and they're drawing something. But and it depends, obviously, if there are other considerations to bear in mind, absolutely. But the normal run of the mill is that when they need the desk, they need a chair, it's off the bed, preferably, you know, without the phone, without the food, the fridge, not in a common area, all of these things. That's what they need. And while they might give you loads of excuses, we need to always be in that space of, you know, how's it going? Now, they don't like it at all, some more than others, obviously. But it is good to have the confidence as adults to ask, well, how's that going? Or check in on the learning, or do you want me to spell check that for you, or whatever it is we have to do. But so structure is still problematic and will be. So we need to keep giving them the scaffolding there. The other thing is consequences, you know, not foreseeing consequences. So you could have there are very tragic stories in this, maybe we know them ourselves, you know, you might say high-performing teens who seem to have it all together. And then I would see this more in the end of maybe college students who do something stupid and something serious happens as a result, because the consequences aren't, they don't tend to think through consequences. Now, as adults, we might want to protect them from that. Okay, the bad stories. But we need to let them know that when you do this, or when you go out drinking, if you did go out drinking, or if you did do the other, if you did do this, this is what happens. And because they don't see consequences, they just think of, oh, that'd be a lot of fun, and just get a group of teenagers together and it all looks amazing. So that's why repetition is so important, you know. The frontal cortex, the executive function, again, which is the memory function, they don't remember things. You'll often find things, oh, I forgot my gym gear, I forgot my ingredients for home economics, or I forgot this, I forgot that. And we can get frustrated with that. And that's, it's good that we try to really help them step into the space of it, and we don't save them from it, and we don't get their home economics ingredients, and sometimes we don't drop them up to the school, or whatever it is. But that's also part of what we're trying to, that the user lose it. We want them to use it so they don't lose it, and so they develop it. Other teams don't struggle with that at all. So you need to, obviously, all of this depends on the team in case. As I said, all of this, you're a hugely important part of your team's life and how they're managing all this. And I can't overemphasize that enough. Encouraging and then helping them to think things through, helping them to reflect, etc. The other things as well is, we mentioned this before, I'll just briefly say it because we said this in the last podcast, but, you know, help them to take healthy risks. You know, whatever those healthy risks are, you know, different experiences that give them a certain independence to explore what it means. They're different to their, maybe their siblings who are in primary school. We mentioned before, you know, when COVID ends, maybe they'll get to do a social project abroad. Maybe they'll get to whatever it is, but maybe it's creative things. And I know some of them in school are writing letters to older people in the community. Maybe it's doing an Irish dance before an old lady who's sitting in her hallway and she's standing in her garden. Maybe it's doing a funny TikTok, whatever it is. It's, you know, trying to think creatively about sort of a healthy, risky behavior. Finding new creative and expressive outlets for their feelings. And I think that's important. And that's where music, art, artwork, painting, drawing, anything like that is wonderful. Because they get to express themselves creatively. Another just to put in there, you've probably all seen it, but there is a great Pixar, which is called Inside Out. You've probably all seen it. It's a great one to sit down, family. It's a Pixar cartoon. It's a great one to talk about emotions. It's quite funny in parts, but it's all about how this teenager is coming to terms with her emotions. And it's a very positive, excellent. And it's helpful for all. But anyway, I think that whole thing of exuberance and joy, we don't want to squash it. Talking through decisions, step by step, you know, and possible consequences, you know, and weighing up the pros and cons, you know, and if you did that, what would happen? And would that be a good plan? And would you be happy with that? Okay, not giving a judgment, not giving an answer straight up, because particularly if it's something a little bit risky or something, they'll try mom and then they'll try dad. And I always give the example, I know a couple who used to laugh at this. Mom was always gone to first because she was seen as the hardcore, no, you're not doing that. And the dad was gone to. And then dad would say, well, and what did mum say? And then he'd say, all right, okay, and of course. And so if you go to that party, oh, that sounds lovely. Who's going to be there? And she kind of perked up thinking, I'm going to get away with this. Yeah, no, it's going to be great, dad. Like all my closest friends are the ones you love. They're all going to be there. They're the ones who are really mature and inverted commas. Oh, that sounds lovely. And so what time does it start at 8 o'clock? And what time does it finish at? Oh, you don't know. Oh, all right, okay. Is it a stayover? It's not a stayover, okay. And whose house is it again? Do I know those parents? Oh, they're lovely. Oh, no, I don't know them. Oh, sure, listen, that's good. And they'll be there, will they? And she's kind of footing through these things. And it's clear, obviously, that they're not going to be there. There's no end date. And, of course, there might be a little sort of backdoor for the boys. Or whatever, you know what I mean? They're just coming over to say hello. So with all that, there's kind of a whole series of questions that aren't answered. And dad hasn't said anything. And he goes, okay, right. Oddy, I'll probably have to think. Mum said no, did she? Yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah. Anyway, sure, we'll see, will we? And then, of course, she stories back to mum and says, dad says no. And, of course, dad hasn't said anything. But anyway, it's just this whole thing of helping them to see, you know, and then they'll get better at it. They'll plug a few holes the next time and say, yeah, no, it's finishing time. It's this, it's that, the other. But my main point here is that you're trying to help them to see how adult decision-making, well, ideally should look, because we're not always the best at it ourselves, but helping them to engage reason, because reason isn't really there yet. So, and the consequences and the impact and the picking up and the dropping off, and even just the thing of, because typically teens think in terms of, obviously, what's really critical is the party and this, and what am I going to wear, and what am I going to be look like, and who is going to be there, and of course, and we think they all look the same, but of course, they don't look the same at all in their eyes, but et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that they've forgotten that there are two other siblings in the family, and there's a pickup at 7 o'clock, and there's another pickup at 10 o'clock at night, and then granny's coming over to stay because she's going to be there for dinner on Sunday. So, of course, we have to have that conversation about, right, and so granny's, well, what are we going to do with granny? But I'd encourage you, no statements, just questions, questions, questions. We'll, of course, encourage them to go. They won't react well to it initially, but of course, they'll begin to realise. And of course, then you can say, look, do you know what, the next time around, do you know what, I think that party's a priority for you, isn't it? So how are we going to work this out? Because you've seen maybe with Dad that this is a priority, and you've seen with the parent what's going on, so you know it's going to be fine. But you know what I mean? So it seems that you are reasonably, you're very reasonable parents altogether, and you're really learning to understand her. But it's just helpful sometimes to try to help her to understand consequences and reasoning. Using family routines, you know, to give your teens a sense of structure, really important. And I have to say, you know, in the programs I run with teens in college, I can see teens who have structure. You know, and I can see teens who don't. And the teens who don't is like they're starting at zero. You know, they're great, but they have a lot to learn. So there are certain rituals that every family has that are non-negotiable. And that's okay. And it can be Sunday dinner. It can be whatever it is, online mass. It can be whatever. It can be we watch a movie and we have pizza. As you know, all the families do this. This is so boring, and I hate the movies we pick. We might have to relook at how you pick your movies, all that kind of thing. But there are rituals there, and they're not movable. And it also helps our teams to put their emotions, to put their lives at the service of something greater, which is called community. You know, we're individuals, but we're in the context of family, we're in the context of other. And that's a huge, huge part of us growing into that emotional space, which is called flourishing, is to be interconnected, to be interdependent. And we need to do that in the family and at home. And providing boundaries and opportunities for negotiating boundaries. So, you know, there's always the carrot and the stick approach. And, you know, you may be in favour more of one or the other. And so one of you might be more in favour of the carrot, one of you might be more in favour of the stick. I really encourage reasoning. But there are certain boundaries that aren't negotiable. And so with the non-negotiable boundaries, it's good to also have the conversation about, well, you know what? No, I know you don't like this, and it is a pain, and you don't like doing this, hon. I know you don't. But this is what we do as a family. And I'm sorry, it's the same for everyone. As if, gee, there's the boundary. There it is, there's Mr. Boundary, Mrs. Boundary. Can't do anything about it. It's there. You know, we wouldn't be us if we didn't have it. But having said that, if, for example, something happens as overuse of phone, okay, and overuse of phone is a big one, and I'm not a fan of it, so I won't be coming down in favour of using the phone. But I suppose negotiating with our team, as you mentioned the last time, in terms of use of phone, okay, what do you think is reasonable? And they'd often pull it back. So there is some element of negotiating there. And obviously being a positive role model, insofar as we can, being a positive role model as a caring adult, not a perfect role model. And it's important that our teams, you know, that we own our, we can wear our faults. And what they consider as a fault really isn't a fault. It can just be a nice city idiosyncrasy. You know, Mum, you always do this. Dad, you always, so embarrassing. Whereas really it's not that embarrassing at all. It's just that it's embarrassing at a particular moment in their life. So it's important that we can own our idiosyncrasy, and it's okay. And staying connected, obviously, is hugely important with our teens' inner world, their outer world, with their activities, with their friends, being open and approachable, you know, having moments in our week. And I know some parents I've talked to you about it, have moments with each teen, and I think that's pretty impressive. But where you can coincide in this downtime, whether it's walking the block, you know, doing the walk in the 5K at the moment or whatever, there's an awful lot of family time. So there are opportunities there. And do talk to your teen about their developing brain, but in a fascinating way, as opposed to, you know, look what's not happening. And just, oh my God, there's so much possibility here. You know, I've probably pruned a lot of it away, and it's not there anymore. So thinking strategies as well is very important, helping them to think with rationally. And this is more challenging now than ever. And it's also something more exciting than ever, because it's something this generation really badly needs, because we live in a very polemic world where it's a lot of name calling, a lot of aggressive behavior. And a lot of just really just behavior that, you know, you just wouldn't want to see in anyone. So we're trying to help our teens is to think more logically. Now, I'll throw in a few things, chess, things like that, where they think logically, they're all great. Now, but if you're not into chess, you know, don't worry about it. I am into some, but I know people who are. But thinking logically about things, you know, I suppose how to help them to follow through on things, you know. Sometimes I always talk about movies and films, movies, films and books, as great ways of doing that. And thinking more abstractly about things, trying to help them to understand things. If there's anybody at home who's into maths and lateral thinking, that's a great one. you know, what, you know, a whole series of clues, and then they have to work out who done it or whatever. And they really will try to work at it. Picking up more on other people's emotional cues. So, for example, because teenagers naturally tend to be sort of navel-gazing, it is a natural space that we need to help them to step out of. It's helpful to draw them in on things rather than say, you know, would you ever think, you know, and this can happen, would you ever think you're a sister? You know, would you put the, would you ever, you know, it can be better to maybe do things like, do you know what, I notice dad's a bit stressed or mum's a bit stressed. What can we do? What do we do? Will you ever think about it? Because you're great at thinking of things. Or it's so-and-so's birthday. Or do you think she'd enjoy this? Or could we help somebody rest a little more there? Or whatever it is. Or if this is an outburst at school, you know, you can always say, listen, do you think she's a bit stressed? Is she having a COVID moment? Do you remember the way last week you had one of those? Maybe that's the way she reacts. Because each of us has an emotion that we tend to resort to more. You know, some people get quiet and tearful and maybe, you know, shrink into a little ball. Others get angry and belligerent. Others get hyper, you know, electric eddy-like types. Or whatever. Others get fearful. So, you know, sometimes our teens think that everybody should react the way they react. But of course, nobody does, except for maybe somebody else in the family. So, again, I suppose helping them to get better perspectives all the time. Encouraging empathy, again, is another way of flourishing. You know, and that's what we talk about, their feelings, you know, and other people's feelings. Films are great for that, I have to say, because you can talk them out, up and down and in and out. Highlighting the fact that people have different circumstances, different perspectives, and they're all valid. And that's really important. And I think it's also to bear in mind that empathy isn't fully developed there. And also because of their increased screen time. And I've mentioned many, many times in these talks that more and more studies are showing that teens have more of a challenge being empathic because they're spending less time talking. They spend more time texting or whatever. And also they're finding it harder to read adult faces. So that's also important to bear in mind. And then just trying to match our language with our teens' understanding. This is important. Now, it's not just a teen thing. You know, they say nowadays, sound like my mother, but that we have reduced our language to really just what's immediate communication, you know, almost like texting language, quick, snappy, soundbitey. So as a result, our language skills have become somewhat impoverished. But as teens, they don't understand sometimes a lot of what we say. So it's because maybe they're thinking about something else, because they're a bit emotionally flooded, they're tired, they don't really want to be listening, whatever it is. So it's good that we check in that they understand it. Now, it can be annoying sometimes to say, did you understand what I just said there? So you might just say, do you know what I mean? Or what would you understand of that? Or what would you think about that? Involve their engagement to help them with that. And then again, decision-making, problem-solving, all of this. So when they come up with scenarios that seem absolutely unfixable, helping them to take out the piece of paper and go, well, how would you do it? And don't come up with a fixed answer. Because if you come up with a fixed answer, the danger is all the learning that's taking place is lost. So slow it down to speed it up. Sleep and the teenage brain is critical, as you know, that they... And the typical thing parents say, why, she never wants to go to bed and I can never get her up. What is the story? Well, the truth is they need 3 or 4 hours more sleep than we do because there's an awful lot of growth taking place, physical, emotional and otherwise. And I suppose that's important for us. And to encourage the winding down before bed, an hour before bed, no screens, that they have a comfortable kind of sort of tidy, relatively tidy, clean environment, regular sleeping routine. They do need 8 to 10 hours sleep a night, as we know. And then the other thing just to mention here, I suppose, is risk-taking behaviour. Again, it's necessary. They need to build it in, because if we don't build it in, they go looking elsewhere, because they do need to test their boundaries. And again, I suppose... I think it's good to talk about that, you know, I won't sort of prescribe anything because obviously COVID is slightly different here, but it is important to talk about that at home, you know, what kinds of things you can do with your team that just give them that, you know, sort of get out of jail card a little bit. Okay, just to go into more, that was more the flourishing end of things. I wanted to look a little bit more on the stress end of things. It is important to bear in mind that teenage brains, because they're developing, are a little bit more, you might say, vulnerable to stress at different stages, okay? And that can include everything. It can be everything from starting a new school, as you first, your parents will well know. It can be, you know, friendship concerns. It can be moving house. It can be the death of a loved one. It can be all of those things. So the first thing is, as caring adults, is to be connected to them and to see how they cope with stress. Because and to talk through it, and then what do you do, and to see what they do. You know, you can see what they, you know, what they they're very, very unaware sometimes. You know, sometimes it's just they zone out at the table, you know, they're under pressure. Sometimes their eating patterns change. Sometimes they get angry, they're moody, they're irritable, etc. Sometimes they look for more time on their own. Now, obviously with social media and phone use, that's more problematic because it's hard to know, are they on the phone or are they just stepping away from people? And that's not healthy in the long run. So it's good to have them, you know, the corner of our eye, you know, in that regard. Obviously they need certain times on their own, that's no problem. But it's just to be aware of that. You know, if the stress is getting too much, what happens is they tend to step away a little bit from interactions. It can be in some scenes. Again, they find it hard to talk about embarrassing and uncomfortable topics. You know, their bodies are changing, they're changing, they don't know how they feel about things, etc. But what they do really appreciate is the support and the listening ear. And then you might frequently hear, maybe you don't, I hear from some parents that say to me, oh, the line I get is, you're so judgmental, Mum, you're so judgmental. Any opinion is judgmental. So I suppose it's important not to react to that because that's just part of the narrative at the moment. But you know your teen best. So, and I think it's very important that you know that. And, you know, you trust your instinct there. So I suppose to look a little bit at what anxiety is, as I mentioned at the very beginning, it's an emotion. It comes from fear. And the amygdala is that part of the brain that regulates that. It's a negative response to, as I said, to adrenaline. And it can lead to flight. And it can lead to all of the responses I've just mentioned above. The positive response to this is trying to identify what the fear is with our teen and go, well, how could we work through that? Or how could we step into that? Or how can we, you know, help them to face what's uncomfortable? Because the more they face it, the more they build up the muscle. And that's resilience. As I said, that's not a behavior we're born with. It's something we need to learn. And it's impressive to see how teens become so resilient. Everybody feels anxious sometimes. Mum and dad feel anxious. Of course they do. COVID has taught us all that. So it's not something we're saying is going to go away. It's not something that we don't talk about. Use another word for it. Call it fear if you want, worrying, whatever it is. And typically worry or anxiety or fear is about not living in the present moment. And we as adults experience that, don't we? We want to be in the past if it's been good and we edit out the bad bits. Or we want to be in the future when it's over. We don't want to be here right now. So worrying or anxiety is almost a rejection of the present moment. And life is the present moment. So whether it's a case of, I don't want to study because I'm afraid of maths, so I don't study, so I'll go and do something else. Well, that's a failure to live in the present moment. So again, it's all about trying to help our teens to step into what the present moment is right now. Because what happens is otherwise, everything builds up. So to use a boring example of study, it all builds up. So all of a sudden, they have three tests on Monday, and they haven't lived in the present moment, potentially, for the last 3 weeks, studying on time, getting on top of it, asking questions in class. And all of a sudden, this has become a meltdown moment. As what you're trying to help them to do, usually what happens is the best learning takes place when they're at that point of meltdown. And you go, okay, how can we, de-escalate that? And okay, what happened here? Why did that go so wrong? If you were to do this differently, how would we do this? Because you're telling them by the we that we're in this together. Okay, how would we do this different? Okay, so we could do a bit more study. But in fairness, on a Monday night, but a Tuesday night you've got your sports on. So that's not a good, that's not what we're going to get a lot of extra study done. Should we do a little bit of the weekend? It's a conversation, it's a negotiation. The pen and paper need to come out. It can't be theorizing and it can't be spoken about without writing it down. If it's not written down, it doesn't exist because there's nothing to refer to. And that's your Bible for the next month to deal with that particular fearful space or that anxious moment. So I think it was just so, it's unfamiliar territory for our teens because, let's face it, as primary school children, they were in the same space, the same teacher for so many years, and there's a lot of things they were getting on top of, and they were the queen of the pack, as it were, and now they're stepping into all sorts of new experiences, and everything is new. So it's when we're faced with the unfamiliar, obviously there are stressful situations and there are objectively dangerous situations, but it's a normal reaction. But it's when it's allowed to frame their reality. In other words, because as we said, if they don't step into the present space, into the present moment, they won't live in their reality. So as an adult, they may be tempted not to live in other realities. I don't want to face that relationship. I don't want to face that decision. I don't want to face that conversation. And they've got used to avoidance. And they've got used to anything that creates anxiety, they step away. And that's not something we want. So it's very common, it can be very worrying for them, but it's part of the normal range of emotions. And that's really, really important for our teens. And I suppose it's also breaking it down. I don't know if you're familiar with Brené Brown. She's got a very good TED talk on all about vulnerability, which I think we might share with you after this. But she talks quite a bit about her own teenage daughter and going for swimming trials, and how she knew it was going to be, she was too young to be in a particular swimming competition. Everybody was there. There was a whole lot of reasons that made it very stressful for her. And it's such a very, very good example of a parent going, you know what, let's see what she does here. And she did in that moment, because, you know, her parents said, well, you need to make this choice yourself. It's up to you or whatever. But they were encouraging her to step into that space. And she did. And she came last. But she said to her mom afterwards, Mom, thank you for that. Thank you for that experience. Incredible, isn't it? I mean, for a teenager to be able to say that's real parenting there. When somebody thanks it, and you remember that as an adult, don't you? You always have that at the back of your mind. Okay, I know it's 8:25 now at this stage, so I will need to be finishing up. So just to, I suppose, a few final comments on, I suppose, acknowledging our teen's fears, acknowledging them. Don't dismiss them, don't ignore them, because that will just ratchet them up. And they need to know we'll be there to support them. Encourage them to do things they're anxious about. So, how can we break this down? How can we break this down? You know, the big block of cheese, the awful situation, break it down. Break it into small goals. Help them to meet those goals. And I suppose help them to put things to bed. The fear of performing in front of other people. You know, that's always going to live with them. But help them to realize, to overcome that fear. Look, they're going through the same thing as you. We need to help them to verbalize those fears. And try not to make a fuss. If certain situations, they don't step up to the plate, you know, and that's important. Helping them to explore and understand their feelings are a very, very important part of all of this. And it's good to also acknowledge that the emotions are good. You seem really excited about that. That's great. You know, putting names on their emotions, because they sometimes don't understand them. They don't see them. All they do is experience them. And that it's normal to go through a whole range of emotions as a teenager. Giving them lots of love and support also means not labeling them. You know, you're very shy, you're very anxious, you're very this, you're very that. Labels are never helpful, you know, because they tend to step into that. Giving them affection, you know, telling them regularly that you love them and you're proud of them and whatever it is, and they did well in X, Y, or Z. And as I said, family life and routine is really, really important in all of this. And I suppose ultimately there are obviously situations that are a bit more complex, they're a bit more challenging. And I'm aware of them. And that's where we need to look for help with those things, professional help early on. And I think, and the lovely thing about teens, as I said, is that the great plasticity, the great building of resilience, which you're trying to help them with as well in school, helps them to, you know, and if they do get that professional help, those who need it early on, well, then you can see how it can help and they can just get them started into learning better behaviours in terms of dealing with their coping mechanisms. And I think in all of this is we're not trying to win every battle, we're trying to win the war. And I know that sounds a bit negative point to end, but we won't win every battle with our teens. But we need to keep thinking, and I often use this, we're not into McDonald's parenting, which is quick fixes. You know, make her happy, get rid of the negative emotions, she'll be fine. Now, McDonald's parenting doesn't work. At least a long term, you might say, damage. We're into the marathon here. There's no sprints, there's marathons. And the marathon here is there'll be more failures before there'll be the successes. Because failure is the greatest way to learn. We learn from our mistakes. And here we learn, we are helping our teams to face the consequences of their mistakes in a calm way. We'll just see how we build up their resilience all the time, and they're able to step into spaces that they didn't maybe a year ago. And that's what's fascinating. And you'll notice that with their siblings. They'll be able to, you know, to notice, you know, that, oh, you know, things that challenge the siblings that they're over right now. And that's because we as caring adults aren't afraid to maybe pull back a little bit. And I also think it's just one other little point that I've often found very helpful. As caring adults, and I'd say for yourself as parents, sometimes when there is a stressful situation that you feel like, you know, saying, well, you know, it could be a friendship, and you see that girl shouldn't have said that, or that boy shouldn't have said that, and that's very negative. They say something, a word they don't understand, and it's a very loaded word, and it's affected your team naturally. Your tendency is to rush in. Now, I'm not talking about bullying or things like that, but I'm talking about other situations where potentially somebody said something that they didn't understand and it was a one-off and it was whatever. We can feel tempted to jump in there. And I said this before, is it's really important that we don't, because they get used to us doing that, and they get used to not claiming that space for their own, and they get used to... And they don't, overall, it doesn't build their confidence. It makes them slip back all the more, because every time they question their own autonomy over their own space. And I think that's important. And it's natural as parents that we tend to think of they're your daughters. But I would think, step away from them and think, if this was somebody else's daughter, how would I advise that parent? That's a helpful one. You know, because it means we step out of it, and it's very hard to do. We step out of the space of thinking, I need to defend, which is a natural parent response. To think, well, what's the best for my daughter here? Is this something that I need to help by supporting my daughter to do it, as opposed to stepping in front of her to protect her? And I think, and we do protect them when they need to, but we need to nurture them in other situations. Okay, I think that's it. Shinawel.